All right, so this is counseling part two. We're doing the rest of instruments. And this is the kind of where he gets into the paradigm that he's presenting. So if the first chapters are foundational chapters, this is where there's kind of the paradigm he's created to put it into action. So love, know, speak, do is that four simple words. Just over the years, thinking about this and having some opportunity to apply it, it's a very helpful paradigm. And when I say paradigm, you want to hear that in contrast to a formula. A formula is this is how you fix this problem that someone's facing. You go through these seven steps, and they are good to go. You know, you start here, end here, and if you follow the formula as I've mapped it out, then they will be happy and content and love God more than ever. That's a formula. But a paradigm is a way of thinking. It's a way of it's kind of guiding principles, and so that as you're in this relationship, you're going to navigate, you're going to tick and tack, and you're going to make a lot of momentary decisions based on where the person is or where the conversation goes, and if you have a formula, that becomes problematic, right? Oh wait, we skip step three. You can't go to step four yet. You know, you brought up that question, but that, we don't get that till step four. But if it's a paradigm, then you're fine. You just go, okay, great. You know, if I thought we were going to get to the doing later, but you're ready for me to lay on some practices that might be helpful for you. And so I thought we were just at the loving. I'm getting to know you, whatever. So whatever. So paradigm, and actually that's the thing with CCEF, a lot of their material, some of what people really appreciate also aggravates other people. It isn't very formulaic, but I find it very helpful because it's not formulaic. It gives great principles, gives a good paradigm for how to see people and how to think about change. So let's dive in here. So first, some counseling. You know, when we're using... This is counseling part two. That's the missing part there on your outline. Counseling part two.
counseling part.
Right. Right. It's the counseling part. And we're saying counseling just because we want to see the whole range of possible counseling situations. So a friendship involves counseling, so you need advice. That's a kind of counseling. There's peer-to-peer counseling, so you know Scott exhorts me in some way in my life. That's counseling. And then there's formal counseling where you know maybe you just decide in a given context you're going to start meeting with someone on a very regular basis, and it's kind of clear actually in that relationship that you're the one that's kind of the giver and they're the receiver. It's not an absolute thing, but in general, you know they're just a young Christian. They need your kind of regular sustained input in a given context. It's kind of a discipleship type relationship, and so you're the counselor and they're the counselee, as it were. So it could be that kind of relationship. Or on, you know, depending on what God has for you in the future, you could find yourself in the position of being a counselor. So they come to you because they are struggling with an addiction and they need your help to help them live out that battle. And so it's a kind of a formal type counseling situation. I don't mean paid counseling, but even just a more formal type situation. And so we're saying counseling is all of those things. So it's just, you know, words exchange for the sake of that person's growth. Or I think I had, you know, the right words at the right times to bring about change in people's lives. So that's all set up. So let's get into the paradigm here. So love, no, speak, do. So the first part here is where we tap into the second great commandment. We're loving our neighbor as ourself, and it gets expressed in this given relationship. And so Tripp defines kind of his love step this way. Love highlights the importance of relationships in the process of change. Theologians call this a covenantal model of change. You know, if you're Reformed, you have to use the word covenantal as often as possible. So Tripp is Reformed, so he uses covenant here. Theologians call this a covenantal model of change. God comes and makes a covenant with us. He commits himself to be our God, and he takes us as his people. In the context of this relationship, he accomplishes his work of making us like him. And so I think two things are good to to grab there. One is in the context of relationship. That's really critical. In the context of relationship. And then he makes us more like him. And so in the context of a relationship, our goal is to make that person more like Christ. It's also to make, you know, them more like him. So that establishes the context and establishes the goal of, you know, this given relationship. In some ways, that's your goal in all relationships, right? It's always to make the person that you're in a relationship more like Christ. So you have a million different kinds of relationships, but in some ways, the goal in every single one of those is to make them more like Christ. And so the closer that person becomes, the more that's really a living, breathing goal. But context of relationship, that's key there. And so a place like Ephesians 4:15 brings that out. So there's tons of biblical foundation to that point of loving. So rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. So the body of Christ grows up, develops, strengthens. But the means for that happening is speaking the truth in love. You know, it's a very lofty spiritual goal, and yet it happens through this very prosaic, you know, pedestrian way. You speak to each other, but you're speaking truth, and you're speaking the truth in love. So the love component is just so critical. You know, Paul, probably the most, you know, vivid way Paul gets at that is 1 Corinthians 13:1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. You know, that's just a vivid metaphor, right? I mean, you think about the scenarios that Jordan was leading us through. I mean, that's so much the goal, right? Is I want to be a trusted voice of love for this person. So truth and love to this person. I do not want to be a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. You know, Lord, help me to do the things and to say the words in such a way that I will not be a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal, just part of the offensive noise of their life. I want to be part of truth and love. I do not want to be part of clanging cymbals, noisy gongs. So based on your experience as speakers of truth and as receivers of others trying to speak truth, how would you say amen to what Paul Tripp is saying there in terms of the importance of love, the starting point of love? In what ways would you say he is exactly right?
I think, I don't know if this is directly from the chapter, but the curses instead of blessings, that's extremely true. And I feel like that at times, even in a marital relationship, like when my wife says very true things about my, but it's sometimes not in the most loving way. It feels like that curse, like, and that maybe that's, but yeah, it feels like her words are daggers, but they're so when it's, you know, come at it with a loving attitude, it's like, wow, that was something I needed to hear and work on.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, marriage, obviously both directions is a, we can all amen in there.
I think speaking truth without love, right, it actually turns people off to the truth oftentimes.
Yeah.
I mean, people are very aware of when you're just trying to fix them. And I think that can actually have the opposite effect of what the goal actually is.
So let me ask, that's something that we kind of talked about in the last session, and they talked about relational capital. We should never avoid trying to speak truth, but I mean, it sounds like we should avoid speaking lots of truth when we don't have the convenience of being able to establish relational capital. I mean, is that essentially?
One of the things I was struck with Tripp is in so many of his stories, he would hear the initial thing and have some initial thoughts, but then as he heard more of the story, then he actually like built that mean, he wasn't building trust in the same sense that we do with friends and relationships. They were there for counseling, but he was still building the trust in that he was listening, he was hearing, and he waited to give his answers and his results until he had the whole picture, right? And while it didn't, I don't think it ever changes the truth aspect, right? It doesn't change what the biblical definitions of what truth is, but it does change how we come at that for this particular instance, right? And how we relate to those people in the context of their story that they're bringing, in the context of what they're struggling with and what they're going through. So I think that, to me,
actually, it is like, I mean, just for the kind of blatant example, like street preaching or talking to somebody like on the street or on, you know, on a bus or in the, I mean, we don't take subways, but, you know, like in those scenarios, I mean, your opportunity for, or on an airplane, I think we can all relate there, but like we have an opportunity there, but we do not have the convenience of, we have 2-3 hours max to, that's our relational capital.
Like, I don't think love means relational capital, though.
Right.
I think those are two very different things. Like, it's great when you can establish a relationship to express love to a person.
Yeah.
But speaking the truth in love speaks to your motive and why you're doing it, not how much you know them.
Yeah, he doesn't say love so that you may eventually speak the truth. He says speak the truth in love. And it kind of gets back to what we were talking about before. Like, I'm just not so sure. Like, the goal is not to sort of hide the fact that we disapprove of this behavior in the hopes that at some point in the future they'll have liked me enough that I can then speak the truth to them and spring this on them.
Yeah.
But I don't think we should separate these ideas of love and speaking the truth. It's not one so that you can eventually get to the other.
Yeah.
It's like the street preacher could be preaching because he just hates people who do certain sins, right? That's a terrible motive to be street preaching. But he could be preaching because he's been rescued by Christ. And
you know, truth without the concept of or context of love is obnoxious. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to understand.
Say that again?
The truth without the context of love is obnoxious.
Yeah. But with love, it can be infectious.
Very good. I love that. I'm going to add that to it.
We're taking it here to the
point. And I think we should work hard to make it seem infectious.
True.
He cited Colossians 3, and he talked about clothing yourselves with compassion. Mm. Put on men as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. So that's just when you go out, put on your coat, put on your compassion coat. It's cold out there.
And so I think maybe one response to the airplane scenario is that's actually helpful because you know, notwithstanding what John and Brad said, so our motive is critical, but in terms of like let's say the benefit of an airplane is you know exactly how long you have, right? At least basically, you know, it's transcontinental versus, you know, I'm flying to Orlando. So, I mean, in some ways, love knows speak too works really well there. Hey, I'm not going to start the conversation with, if you were to die tonight, would you go to hell or heaven? You know, where would your confidence lie? You're going to start the conversation with, hey, within my time constraints, I'm going to establish some kind of relationship. So I'm not just some crazy guy swooping in, you know, to yell at him. But I can't spend the whole hour asking about their child because, you know, you have an agenda. You know, I may never see this person again. It's worth becoming a fool for Christ in that context, you know, all those things. And so, you know, I wouldn't, you know, you could, and in some ways this is a scalable model. You could say it that way, right, in today's vernacular. If I have 15 minutes, I can still do love, no, speak, do. If I have 15 years, you know, sometimes in a home group you have 15 years, or in a marriage, obviously even longer sometimes. You scale it, right, accordingly. Jordan's not sure.
I mean, you're not guaranteed tomorrow. So if you,
but you're not guaranteed tomorrow.
Take the perspective that,
yes,
like, oh, we've got a lifetime. Like, that might be shorter than you think.
Yes.
So
I think it's also important that
that's also true.
We're not all called to be everything to everyone all the time, right? we play a part, and it's important to remember our part in whatever context.
Yeah, you do have to.
Yeah, I think in deciding our motivation, we can't decide that there's a truth that we're going to share with someone.
I think our motivation needs to be, we need to love this person with sharing the truth that God has laid on our hearts to share to them. So if we're like driving towards a particular truth that we're going to tell this person, we're probably missing the love aspect of it. And sometimes I think loving someone is not necessarily telling them all the truth, because maybe we're not going to be loving telling all the truth because they're not ready for all that truth. So being a part of God's bigger picture is trusting that he's giving us, choosing sometimes to give a smaller amount of truth is more loving than cramming all the truth down their throat.
Yeah.
He said something later. So there's a mistake we often make when we seek to lead someone to repentance is to emphasize the law over the gospel. And I just find for myself, like when I'm trying, like, am I speaking truth without love? Like, usually what that looks like is speaking like the law parts of truth. Like, oh, well, you're doing that wrong and you need to change there. And that's actually an incomplete truth. It's not even that, like, yeah. What I'm saying is, like, I'm telling you all the truth just without love. Like, no, I'm leaving out, like, the grace and gospel parts of the truth that are actually going to be most effective at growing in repentance.
Yeah.
So, like, I'll fool myself into thinking, like, I'm just all truth. It's like, no, you're missing truth, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is a good model, Peter meeting Cornelius. And that could be a model for us. The reason I say that is because when Peter went to Cornelius, he didn't necessarily know what he was going to say, because he asked Cornelius, okay, I'm here, we're all here in the presence of God, why have you brought me here?
Mm-hmm.
And Cornelius told him, and when we meet people, you know, we can ask the Lord, why have you brought me here? What's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And then Cornelius told him what, you know, the dreams and visions that he had, and then what does Peter do? He opens his mouth and says what he says.
No, I know.
Yes, that's right.
Well, there's also kind of the idea of, like, what is the tone of your heart? Because if the tone of your heart is, I've been redeemed by grace, and I'm living in peace of that truth, that's what you're going to talk about. That's how you're going to demonstrate your life to four people, whether it be 15 minutes or whether it be 15 years. That's how you're going to live your life. That's the truths you're going to speak are those truths. And sometimes it will relate to difficult things, or it will relate to the law and how that is impacted, you know, how the grace is impacting me based on the law. If we are people who are tuned only to judgment and, you know, abiding by if we're living in a way that is condemning, and we are under condemnation, we've put ourselves under condemnation, we're living under condemnation, then we're going to speak in condemnation to those around us. And that may not be love, but it's definitely not hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, because we're actually talking about the speaking part right now, but we're in the love part of the paradigm. So, I mean, my question is this. This is for everybody. So if we're convinced that loving a person is an effective way to minister God's truth to them when we ultimately do speak, so if we're convinced that love is the first step, and we also know that there are people in our lives that are difficult to love, or we don't love them. So the question, right now, everybody's got somebody in mind that you already know. They're difficult. Loving them means we work hard to cultivate that affection for them. So I'm curious, what are things that you do to cultivate affection for those people who are difficult to love, to be able to accomplish the next steps of the new world, the next part of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And good clarification. Yep.
The most helpful word for me there has been, so there's some books that have, you know, there's one chapter that's worth the price of the book. So in Packer's Knowing God, it's the chapter on adoption. And in Lewis's Mere Christianity, it's the chapter on love. And he talks about the love cycle, how the practice of love feeds our feeling and experience of love, and our feelings of love feed our practice of love. And it's this happy chasing, one chasing the other, chasing the other. And he says, just just love people. So pray for them, serve them, and pray for your own heart. And that actually is a very practical, good way of feeding and fueling the love. Daniel, you often put it in terms of the treasure and heart principle, that where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And that's a loop, too. As we invest in something, our heart, where it grows, and as our heart, where it grows, we want to invest more in it. And I think that's a powerful tool to growing in love.
It's kind of a fake it till you make it situation,
but
right?
Way, God ordained, totally. This is how God has made our
in the best sense, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's also important to recognize that the truly loving people the way God would have us love them isn't natural for us, and it's a supernatural work of the Holy Spirit in us. Yeah. And so to cultivate that means that you're cultivating a love for the glory of God, and He will give you the love for people. I know that's probably the hardest thing for me in sharing the gospel is loving the people I'm sharing it with. And I recognize my own flesh rising up almost every time I do it. I want them to believe what I believe first, you know, and it's like I'm going to argue them into the kingdom. And it never works out that way.
Ever. No. So, not in the moment.
Daniel mentioned 1 Corinthians 13. It does tell us gives us one description of love. Love is patient, love is kind, love is humble. So cultivating love, at least one aspect, I think, is cultivating those attributes.
Yeah.
Being patient with somebody that all they're doing is talking and you can't get a word in. That's an opportunity to cultivate patience and humility. So I think that may not give us the specifics, but it does tell us what our attitude and heart is. And when you do cultivate that, then even when you speak hard things into people's lives, a lot of times they will accept them because you're doing it humbly, or you've been patient, you're not trying to ram it down their throat. So I do think 1 Corinthians 4, though, verses 4 to 7 are really, really important because they describe what love is.
Yeah.
Not totally, but...
So one of the practices that's been hit on is praying for people. One thing I've noticed there is, it's very easy for me to kind of have the group devotion version of my prayers, where I'm just like very formulaic and praying for them. But what I found is, the more consistently that I pray for somebody, the more and the longer I pray. It's really easy for me to like say a couple things in like a 30-second prayer. But if I say I'm going to set aside, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to pray for this person, it's pretty hard for me to fake it for 5 to 10 minutes. Eventually, like, God's really going to engage my soul there.
Yep. That's true. That's a good insight. Yeah.
I can't just say some of my like standard prayers for several minutes. And then the other thing is just to pray scripture over those people, because that really transforms the way I pray. And so then it's not my words. It's not my words like what I want for that person to change, right? No, this is the word of the Lord and what the word says about this person. And that really is, there's been a lot of people in my life I've just had a hard time with, and that's been just one of the practices that, if done well, praying over people consistently and for a long time really can transform our hearts. Mm.
That's true. Let's move to number two, no. And I think, Scott's observation about, you know, ideas worth the price of admission. Actually, there's a bunch in Trip. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. That's probably, if you want one insight, that's probably the insight. But second, at no additional cost. I think the knowing thing is really powerful because it actually answers Jim's question. I do find the more I know someone, the more I love them. The more I understand why they do those, why they're such a jerk, the more I understand that, actually, the more I'm okay with them being a jerk. You know, it becomes less personal and less about my reputation or my comfort or my convenience. And you're just able to overlook things. You're able to walk out some of those 1 Corinthians 13, patience, kindness, not self-seeking ideas, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. When you just tap into someone's story, you realize their childhood was really horrible. Not just in kind of a proverbial, wow, I had such a hard parent set of parents, but like really, really rough. And it's scarred them internally in a way that just continues to get relived or lived out. So,
you should send the Beekner
One of my, I'm a supervisor in Durham, and there's another supervisor, advanced supervisor for like 16 years, worked at UPS for 30 some years. He was one of the guys who did the training class when I first went driving like 5 years ago. He doesn't remember that I was in his class. But everyone in the class talked about how, like, he is a very blunt, he's a jerk, pretty much. But I'm in the office with him every day for the past 2 years, almost every day. And, like, being around him, interacting with him, like, one-on-one, everyone else still thinks he's a jerk. But if you interact with someone one-on-one, then you realize, oh, maybe they are a jerk to everybody else. But if you interact one-on-one, he can still be a jerk one-on-one, but he's not as much.
He's not only a jerk. There's more to him.
When you have a relationship and you like talk to someone more and just realize, oh, they're just a simple guy, he's a jerk, and you have a better idea, like you were saying. That's great.
Yeah. So no, this is a Tripp's quote. So no has to do with really getting acquainted with the people God sends our way. When you assume that you know someone, you won't ask the critical questions you need to ask to get below the surface. Knowing a person means knowing the heart. So that's kind of the discipline of getting to know someone. You know, beware of beware of presuming. You know, make sure that when you're guess about the truth that they need, make sure that's right. And so you test it with more knowledge of the person.
And that's a step we need to not forget, even with people that we are acquainted with in church.
Or your wife. I mean, sometimes you have to catch yourself, like those times where you know what she's going to say. Like, you just have to back up and say, no, you don't. You do not know what she's going to say. She might say that. She's said that a lot of times in the past, but you don't know that. You don't know that she's going to say that. I think sometimes what robs us of the romance of early days in marriage is you just presume you know your wife. She's the familiar. And it is a little bit of a discipline to remind yourself that, no, she's the stranger. She still is. She's a mystery to discover, you know, after however many years you've been married, and she always will be. But we get into, even in a long-term relationship where we actually do know a lot about them, you get into trouble by presuming, in other words.
Little puppets in our head that we think we know, and we figured everyone out, and it's so hard.
Yeah.
That's been most obvious to me, like my kids.
Oh, yeah, kids, yeah, great example.
When you're 6 months old, you actually do know them. Like, you know everything.
Comprehensively.
But then they change, and like, they're not the same person they were 10 years ago.
Yes, that's a good point. Or 10 days ago. Yeah. So we'll think general and specific here. So general things we want to know about people. And this... places of application. You know, this is ideal for, you think, a home group context where there are strangers in your home group, but they're strangers you're getting to know in kind of a long-term way. You have time. You don't have to pack everything into the first conversation you have. So it's ideal in a situation like that. Coworker, this would be ideal. Neighbors, you know, chances are you're going to live next to your neighbor for years and not days. So general things, you know, as we're in this no stage, general things you want to know. So a person's history, you know, their childhood, their conversion, if that's applicable. I actually think, like concentrating on people's childhoods got a bad rap because it was a bit overplayed maybe in certain psychological kind of pop psychology type ways in the 80s or something. But I do think you want to know, like, if you really want to get to know someone, it's so helpful to know their life from 0 to 20. It's so incredibly helpful. There are so many formative things happen before you're 20 that shape you like at the deepest levels, your personality, your responses, your gifts, your weaknesses. I mean, it's so incredibly formative. Obviously, your parents are so formative. You just really want to, like in terms of like, you know, general things I want to get to know. You really want to see that that's a priority. If this is a relationship where your knowledge of the person is going to be really important, you just as much as you can know about that, the better. Trauma, you know, childhood trauma has a disproportionate effect on your life. Trauma when you're 26 is profoundly impacting. Trauma when you're, you know, 6 or 12, 15 is, you know, 10 times more impacting depending on the trauma. So I would just kind of tuck that away. But it really is important. And actually, you know, back to marriage, even though it's not all about marriage, I think that's a place where you can presume knowledge of your spouse. Oh, yeah, she grew up in Ohio. I know her father-in-law very well. Or I know her father very well, you know, whatever. But I think that's a place where there's usually more to unravel there, you know, when you're getting to know your spouse. Conversion, you want to know details about that, depending on the person. So a person's current life, you know, the big blocks of their life, their work life, their marriage life, their children, you know, physical health, financial health, hobbies, those are all significant. Those any one of those can be applying a lot of pressure that's affecting their behavior, their response to things. Person's spiritual life, fears, anxiety, struggles, emotional health, spiritual disciplines. If you're really in a situation where you need to get to know somebody, you need to know those things. You need to know what they're afraid of. What are they struggling with? What is their relative emotional health, psychological health? You need to know all those things because that all affects how you interpret what you're observing, right? So this person's financial anxieties. So this person seems to be making a decent salary, but they're kind of displaying a lot of anxiety about their finances. You know, it's always their prayer requests or whatever. Well, you're observing an action on their part, and you just have to tell yourself, I have no idea why they're anxious about this. It could be their spouse is putting pressure on them in a certain way, and they crave their spouse's approval in a very debilitating way. You know, it could be that they had a very, very, very profoundly poor childhood, and so money has always had a kind of a disproportionate importance in their lives. It's an idol. And when they don't feel like they have enough of it, it is just a totally consuming fear. You know, I'm going to become like my dad, and I've resolved never to be like my dad, and you know, give my kids the childhood that I had. Could be just normal financial anxiety. You know, there's a threat that you might lose your job for a certain. You know, maybe the gender issues. You realize it's coming to the forefront. There's a threat you might lose your job, and most people are going to get anxious in a situation like that. So, and all that is to say, you know, the same sort of behavior can be driven by very different things. And so the more you know about all the factors of their life, the more you can kind of, you can find the truth that is actually applicable. Because that's one thing about speaking truth in love is until you understand the person's situation, you know, the Bible's big, right? There's a lot of truths in the Bible. You know, Jesus is the answer, is the truth, perhaps, in the Bible. But there's just a thousand different truths that this person might need in this situation. So if they're craving their spouse's approval, well, that requires a very different truth than maybe they have just fundamental doubts about God's provision. Which, I mean, there's promises about God's provision, right? The idol of success or the idol of appearing successful and in the eyes of others, well, They don't need your comfort. They need your rebuke. You need to stop doing that. You just need to deny that temptation. But those are all very different truths, right? Same Bible, very different truths. Same situation, very different truths that are applicable in the situation. So, that's general knowledge informing, you know, how you're going to specifically speak, and then specific. the specific side of knowing the heart is you're getting into the this particular situation. So now you're taking that same, I'm gonna go into Sherlock Holmes in this particular situation. You know, I'm not asking about your whole 50-year journey. We're gonna talk a lot about your job, your finances, because that's the kind of presenting issue that brought us here. So there too, you're coming in as kind of a disciplined learner. Not the presuming professor, but as a disciplined learner, I'm coming here. I'm going to ask a lot of questions, and I do find the more you ask the questions, the more you know the situation, the more you know why they're doing what they're doing and why they're responding the way they're responding. The more the truth is a little bit more natural, you know, in that kind of give and take. The truth that you go to naturally in the Bible is going to be, it's going to be a little bit more natural. It's not going to be, it's not the Twitter blast, right? Boom, this is generic truth, 407, this is what you need. This is what I say to all people in your situation. But it's, you know, just in the give and take of talking, and you're a Christian who's filled with the Word of God, and as you talk in those situations, the truth is going to come out. So James here is just great, 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 great medicine. James 1:19 through 20. This is kind of the disciplined learning stage. So know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So quick to hear, slow to speak, quick to hear, slow to speak. And quick to hear is really another way of saying quick to ask questions. You know, it's not just hearing, but it's quick to ask questions, quick to seek more information, quick to get a bigger picture, more developed picture. And I think a lot of you guys were tapping into that, even in that, on the gender issue. It's easy to, you know, take your specific coworker who's expressed a preference, and you put on them like the whole LGBTQ political national agenda to take over the culture. Like, it's possible that they're an advocate in some unusual way, but it's also possible that they're just a really confused 23-year-old woman, and they got off track by some really unhelpful friends in high school, and they're just not that person. You know, they're not the screaming, ranting CNN lunatic. There's just this really confused girl, and you don't want to totally miss it, you know, in that kind of situation. So quick to hear, quick to ask questions, slow to speak. Thoughts? Yeah, what do you guys think about the more you know, the better you speak?
His exhortation to not assume things, and then the examples of the specific questions and the way that he kind of walks through the way he asks questions to get to the heart of what's going on. It's really helpful.
Okay, where is that in the book? Anybody remember?
It's actually in a couple different.
Now for some good questions. Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. Page 175 has a ton.
Yeah. I just thought that was really good. Yeah. I always know that's what I need to do.
You still don't always know the questions.
Come up with the right questions, yeah, to actually get to where we need to go.
Yeah.
And so that was.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like
that's a good point.
Categorize things. Hmm. So like the situation, the responses, the thoughts, and the motives.
Yes.
Just because talking to someone, like he had the one anecdote about like this couple came in and just basically dumped like massive problems, and he's like furiously taking notes. He's like, all right, well, I'll pray about it and we'll talk later. And like that's how I feel a lot of times. It's like, All right, I don't even know what all of this is.
Yeah.
And so just categories for what's going on in the situation, their responses, and then internal.
Yeah. So. That's where it's nice not to be a professional counselor. You know, they're paying you $100 an hour to fix them, basically. And if you don't deliver something for every $100, it's gonna, you know, there's just a lot of pressure in that situation. But in a home group situation, yeah, you get the blast of info or the blast of the scenario, and you think, I have no idea what to say, and so you just say, you know what, let's just pray. And that's actually totally fine. You just pray, and you're going to go away, and you're going to think about it. And you're going to add what they just told you to what you already know about them and in the years you've had together. And then you'll come back with a more more ready answer for their scenario.
Asking questions can also be not in the moment. You know, if you end up in that situation where you're just dumped on and continue to pray and consider what they've said and invoke more conversation with questions in a future interaction, that's going to serve someone really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like email them these questions. Like, I think that'd be a really good starting point.
Yeah, that's a good point. Written follow-up is a great... Yeah. That's a great thing to tuck away too.
And through the time and through the actual asking of questions, you're actually allowing them an opportunity to maybe find their own conclusions. I think the idea, which I mean, I think Tripp does communicate this, maybe not more, like obviously, but as we engage with people, we're trying to get them to see the truth themselves, right? And oftentimes, that's the truth that actually makes the big difference in their life. Even if I'm saying the right thing and I've gone through the right process, at the end, if they haven't arrived there themselves, it's not going to mean as much. So just good questions allow them to unpack themselves in front of themselves. And
the thing you discover is more potent than the thing you were told.
Right.
Scott, he's like Proverbs.
Yeah.
That's really true, though.
The book was when he had that guy journal, and then he went through and underlined all the places where anger was coming out. Like the guy was just writing, didn't see that he was an angry person. But then that's
interesting. Yeah.
It was really helpful to him, like you were saying, for him to actually just see, these are my words. And it's just being pointed out, what's going on.
Yeah. Good. Good quote by Tim Keller. This is on idolatry, bottom of page 3. So because we can set up idols in our heart, Ezekiel 14, 3-7, we recognize that making an image of something is not necessarily a physical process, but is certainly a spiritual and psychological one. It means imagining and trusting anything to deliver the control, security, significance, satisfaction, and beauty that only the real God can give. It means turning a good thing into an ultimate thing. That's a great way to say that. Idolatry is turning a good thing into an ultimate thing. It could be argued that everything we do wrong, every cruel action, dishonest word, broken promise, self-centered attitude, stems up from a conviction deep in our souls that there is something more crucial to our happiness and meaning than the love of God. So a lot of times, when you get the angry guy's journal or a real pattern of unloving behavior in a person's life, a lot of times there is an idol, and if you spend time sort of helping them discover what that is, that can be very powerful. You crave other people's worship. You just crave it, and when you don't get it, you just go crazy. So that's, so when you identify that idol, then a lot of times you unpack not just a single issue that they're struggling with, but like a whole array of things that they didn't connect in their minds are totally connected. And when you think in terms of idolatry, that can be a very revealing path of discussion. Okay, let's get to the speaking. In some ways, this is probably the hardest part. So once you've been faithful in the relationship, you love them, they know you love them, you've been faithful to draw them out about their situation, it actually is hard to speak, to come up with the right thing to say. And the truth is, especially if it's the first time you've talked to someone about this a particular issue, it's really hard to have kind of just the right thing to say. So you want to just know that blowing it, because you love them and they know you love them, blowing it in a single conversation is okay. I said that, and then I thought about it later and I realized that was so stupid of me to say. I'm sorry for that. So there's ways you can blow it, but it's okay. So I do think the speaking is, in some ways that's what it's all about, but it's also really hard. It's uniquely hard. I mean, the Bible, the New Testament, it's just, if you think about how often it calls us to speak specifically to help other people grow, it is very often. it has these different ways of saying it. So there's the obvious one we just read, speaking the truth in love, we ought to grow up in every way. But you know, anytime it mentions exhort one another every day as long as it is called today, that none of you, I think it should say, not that one of you, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Sorry, should have just pasted it instead of typed it. None of you may be hardened. Encourage one another and build one another up. So obviously those are very different kinds of speaking there. We'll see 1 Thessalonians 5:11, I think, 5:14. Admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. So there's lots of different kinds of speech we have. So back to Tripp. Speak involves bringing God's truth to bear on this person in this situation. To do this, you need to ask, what does God want this person to see that she doesn't see? How can I help her see it? Speaking the truth in love does not mean speaking grand pronouncements. It means helping your friend to see her life clearly. Yeah, in some ways, it's about which particular truth is needed in the moment, right? Your goal really is just to speak helpful truth. You don't want to say that there's only one verse that's applicable to this person, right? Because that's silly. You just want to speak helpful truth to this person that does generally apply to their situation. You know, the more specifically it can apply, the better. But but there are times where it's acceptable just to. For some reason lately I've been speaking Matthew 28:20 a lot. You know, behold, I'm with you always to the end of the age. But that the promise of Christ being with us always, throughout every day, in every situation, that's encouraging. And actually, there's a lot of different scenarios in which that's encouraging truth to speak to people. But I also recognize that, you know, I can't only say that. I have to have other things, you know. It's not that kind of cure-all. But it is generally, again, the point there is just that you want to say things that are helpful in a at least in a general sense, and the more you speak over time, the more precise you can be. But the goal is just speaking helpful truth. Let me skip five. Speaking God's truth. Bottom of five here. When we speak God's truth, as Tripp says, some categories of things you might consider. And again, your question is basically, what of the almost limitless verses to choose from, what do I want to highlight? So some things you can highlight. And these are less issues-based and more, well, you'll see. So God's character, you know, which aspect of God's character is relevant? That can be useful. If someone's hard-hearted about their sin, you know, you can tell them, you can preach the purity verses, or you can just go to God's holiness. God's character fits there. God's holiness, or God as judge. God is not mocked. What a man sows, this he will also reap. So God's character, he's a good shepherd. You know, there's all kinds of different ways you can just take aspects of God's character and apply it to a given situation. That can be very edifying for people, or convicting. You know, God's commands. You know, there's, you know, in some situations, there's a command this person needs to reckon with. They're being indifferent toward God's lordship. And so you need to just go to the commands and see. Sometimes they just need to see the command in black and white right there. God's promises. There's an array of promises. We read the Bible. Hopefully you're kind of a promise seeker as you read your Bible, and hopefully those promises that you find for yourself can find their way into you helping other people as well. They're very powerful to have if you can have sort of just the right promise for people. In the gospel, you don't want to think too minimalistically about the gospel. The gospel is actually a very broad, comprehensive framework. So this is Mike Bullmore. There's a pastor up in outside of Chicago, and he revealed these things to me. I don't know. It's been a long time now, 20 years ago. But if you think about what the gospel is, you have God as a holy creator. So he makes us and he calls us to obey him. People sin, deserve hell. You have Christ sent to redeem them. And then you have the response of faith required. So that's obviously just a kind of a simple gospel message. Well, the truth is the person coming to you, they need one of those aspects of the gospel, whatever their situation. If it's a stubborn heart given to impurity, they need to know that God is a holy creator. If it's a new believer, they just can't understand why they keep doing what they're doing. They need to understand that, hey, people sin. They disobey his commands. And they need to know that Christ was sent to redeem them, or the other promises about Christ that would connect to them. Or they just need to respond in faith. There's a lot of ways that the gospel itself can become a powerful tool for counseling. And as a final word, what is going to be my final word? So skip to page 10. I think in a church context, this list of doing is especially helpful. Coworkers, obviously, it's less helpful. The proverbial plane ride, not helpful. But in most of the conversations we're going to have, where we really are going to have the opportunity to love, know, speak, do, these kinds of things can be helpful. So helping someone to get on with the doing of the Christian life, be doers of the word and not just hearers. So helping them to practice the spiritual disciplines, very powerful, life-changing. So if you can help them to read their Bibles daily, pray daily, read Christian books, get together with them, life-changing, very powerful. Whatever they're struggling with, they will be helped by that. Accountability, it's every week, every month, direct attention on their issue of sin, very helpful. That helps them to get on with the doing of the Christian life, challenging them to specific obedience, not just general obedience, but there's a specific area of obedience. Could read a book on that. Could be basic steps of responsibility. The guy who's depressed and he's unemployed, just helping him to just be responsible as a man in that situation, looking for work regardless of the outcome. And then ultimately doing is what we're after, is that they love God, love one another, and love their neighbor as themselves. That is, the more that they advance as people who are doing those things, the more they are doers and no longer just hearers.